it back, JoJo. Yeah.
He was there. Apple Records former U.S. manager Ken Mansfield now takes a look back on one of rock and roll's most significant events while bringing an insider's perspective to the days leading up to those 42 fascinating minutes of the Beatles' monumental rooftop concert. His new book is The Roof, The Beatles' Final Concert by the Man in the White Coat, Ken Mansfield, former U.S. manager of Apple Records, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ken to the program. Ken, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Ultimately, what was the story you wanted to tell?
Well, the story basically is centered on the roof, and I was one of the handful of people that were up there and one of the few people that are still alive to this day that were up there. And people write so much about the Beatles, and people are really the facts and all this kind of stuff, and I really wanted to let people know what it was personally like, what the people were like, what the moments with them in the building and on the roof and in the hotels and their cars and et cetera, like, and just, you know, what they were like personally. There was a warmth, there was an emotional aspect of it. And so for people to really look inside that whole phenomena beyond the facts of, you know, and the facts are there. They're very clearly checked out by some of the greatest authorities in the world to make sure that my memory didn't, I guess you could say, warble a little bit.
So there's the picture from that concert, which has you, known as the man in the white coat, standing next to George Harrison, and Yoko Ono is there, Maureen Starr. First of all, explain the white coat.
Well, the white coat is, you know, I would come in from California, and I would jump on a plane and get off in London. And they'd pick me up with a limo, take me to the hotel. I'd walk into the hotel, come back out, limo to the place. So I'd be outside, you know, like 30 seconds at a time. So I didn't worry about how I was dressed as far as warmth, because I would be in the building or in the hotel or whatever all the time. And all of a sudden, I found out we're going up on the roof now. And so I just ran out of the building, and there's a lot of tailor shops and clothiers on Savile Row. So the first place I grabbed the first coat that I could find, just bought it and ran back in there, and it was white. I just grabbed a coat, and it was white. So I get on the roof, and of course everybody's dressed in black, basically. So I mean, I really stood out, which turned out to be a great thing later on, because I'm easy to identify, and I am now the man in the white coat.
Talk about how much. And I use this word loosely, but how much planning went into that concert? At what point did you first start to hear words that this was going to be a thing?
Well, we needed live footage. That was a concept of the Let It Be film. And we planned all these things, and we could never keep them a secret. And so pretty soon, you know, everybody in the world was going to show up where we were doing this thing. So the first time I heard about it is I got a call from Mal Evans. And it said that they wanted him to check out the Sahara Desert and me to check out a desert in America. And the Beatles would set up and play for the whole world could come for free on some desert. And, of course, there are about 20 other options they were exploring, too, the Coliseum and all this kind of stuff. But all these crazy involved things. The reason we ruled out the desert right away was, first of all, who would insure, you know, 500,000 kids in the middle of a desert? And mainly the porta potties. How would you ever get that many, you know, porta potties out there? But anyway, so I just happened to be, Joe, in the building and working in the London office that week. And they were just running out of time. So the day before, I started hearing noise in the building, some construction, and they just strengthened the roof up there. It was a very weak roof, and there wasn't room for very many people. And then Mal just came into the office. I was in and said, "Hey, Ken, we're going up the roof in 15 minutes or something like that." And that was it. It's just a last minute thing. I don't know when it was decided on that, but probably a day or two before. But, you know, I was part of that whole thing, and I didn't even know about it until Mal said that. So it was just really a stroke of luck that I was in London that day and was able to go up, because there was only, you mentioned Yoko, myself, and Maureen, and a girl named Chris O'Dell, who worked for Peter Asher. we were the only four people that you could call an audience up there, because everybody else was, you know, part of the crew or the band or something like that. We were just seated there 4 to 6 feet away as an audience, just watching the show. Don't let me down.
She does. Ooh, she does. Yes, she does. And if somebody loved me like she does, ooh, she does. Yes, she does. First time, don't you know it's gonna last? It's a love that lasts forever. It's a love that has no past. Don't let me down.
Right in the book, considering all those other locations was a waste of time because the Beatles were losing enthusiasm for the film project and becoming more and more resistant to exerting the extra effort to travel any distance to do a concert for just a few minutes of film footage. And you point out that they felt they'd outgrown that sort of thing.
Well, they had, and also I just think the way things were at that time, and this is my personal opinion, is they just didn't really want to spend that much time together. You know, traveling off to some place. I mean, they were talking about some of the craziest places in the world, long way. And you think about taking the crew and just all the stuff involved. It was just too big a headache. And the roof was just, you know, didn't cost anything, no unions, nothing. Just go and do it, or come up and do it, I guess.
It was the final concert. So how much of a realization do you think it was for the band and for those in the Beatles orbit? Did they know that this would be it?
You know, this is a kind of, you're striking on kind of the point I wanted to make in the book. Those of us who were up there, including the band, I don't think anybody knew, other than the fact that something special had happened. We just had this feeling. It wasn't like, oh yeah, this is the Beatles' last concert. Oh yeah, they're going to break up. Oh, this is going to be a historical moment. And all this kind of stuff. Something was just magic up there that day. And we walked out of there and we walked down into the office. We didn't talk about it. It was just something we felt, you know, and everybody was really quiet. And it was almost decades later when myself and the others really started really talking about it and writing about it. At the time, we just knew something really special had happened.
How many people actually witnessed it? I mean, you write in the book, you say, to give an example of how casual this whole affair was, and in some ways a prime indication of how chaotic communication within the organization was at the time, some of the Apple staffers worked straight on through the whole happening without even knowing it was going on.
Yeah, Neil Aspinall did some dental work that day. You know, he's a guy that was never, he and Mal were never 10 feet away from him. They were always with him, and a lot of appeal. Derek Taylor, Deneen Wilber, one of the biggest events for PR they had, he didn't even go upstairs. And a lot of people wanted to go upstairs but weren't allowed because the roof wouldn't handle the weight. So if you look at the picture on the roof, there was probably a square foot area somewhere between 12 and 20 feet, let's say, where the four Beatles were and Billy Preston, the four of us sitting next to the chimney, and Kevin Harrington, who was helping John with lyrics and stuff, and four or five film crew. And we were the only people in that immediate media area. You know, a lot of the pictures you see, it looks like a lot of people because they're on the roofs next door. Or there was another area off to the side where Alan Parsons and some other people were. But the immediate area was like a dozen of us that were right there. The picture on the cover of the book is me standing next to Kevin Harrington. And I'm standing about 3 feet away from Georgia. In fact, I look like I'm in the band.
Right.
And I make a point in there to show how casual it was. I'm standing there where the Beatles are playing, and I'm chatting with Kevin Harrington. I'm not watching him. I'm just standing there, you know, like another day with the Beatles, and chatting as you look at the picture there. And that's just kind of how casual it was, you know, with them that day.
Were there people eventually, after 45 minutes or so, did you have a crowd on the ground?
Oh, gosh. The street was just jammed. I mean, it was just backed up. The sound was down there. We had one of the fellows that worked at Apple who came to work late that day, and he said he rounded the corner onto Sawville Row. And he said, I rounded the corner, and he said there was like a wall of sound coming down the street. And you couldn't. It was a hazard because people were just stopping. Cars were stopping where they were. People were crowding the side. Everybody was just, it was a mess down there. And everybody down there, they knew who it was. They just couldn't figure out what was happening, you know. And, of course, the tailors and the bankers and all those people, they were trying to get the thing shut down as quick as they could. And they were complaining. And the police station was only just virtually a few doors away or something. It's right down the street from there.
I've got a feeling deep inside. Oh, yeah. I can't hide, oh no, no, oh no, oh no, yeah, yeah, I've got a feeling, yeah. Oh, please believe me, I'd hate to miss the train.
So this was in relationship to where the from the Abbey Road studios were. This was how far away from that?
Oh, I don't even know, but it was a ways. It wasn't close at all.
Okay.
You know, I can't remember where things were because I was always in the back seat of a limo and not paying attention, you know.
But it was the roof of the Beatles offices, correct?
Yes, it was the offices. Yeah, it was the five stories up. January 30th, it was cold up there. It was windy. It was cold. It was a dank day. It was really cold. And, of course, that white coat that I bought that I thought was a top coat was actually made to be a raincoat. So as soon as I hit the roof, that thing, I could have taken it off and it stood next to me. It just got stiff. And so it didn't really provide that much warmth. You can see I'm kind of huddled inside the coat in other pictures where, I mean, it was cold.
Now, as far as the session itself of the recording, how do you look at that time and the music that was produced on that roof?
You listen to the raw tapes, and it's amazing how good they played that day. And because, like George, his fingers were so cold that he had me hold cigarettes between my fingers at one time so he could put the tips of his on the coals of the cigarettes. And John was complaining the whole time about how cold his hands were. He couldn't make the chords. But when you listen to the raw tapes, it's amazing how good it was. And the one thing that I was privileged to see up there, and I've seen it in the film later, is there was all kind of dissension, you know, going on, just so many things happening at Apple and with the band, and they almost didn't even come up on the roof. It was like a last minute thing once they got up to the stairs going up there. But when they started playing, something happened, and it's either Paul looked at John or John looked over at Paul, and there was a look, an exchange they made, and it was like, yeah, this is us. We're a band. We've been together a long time. We're deep friends. We're a great band, and this is who we are, what we're doing right now. It doesn't matter about all the other stuff that's going on. This is us. Boy, I saw that look, and it just gave me chills. Other, and different kind of chills.
Warm chills. Right, different than freezing to death.
Yeah.
You were former U.S. manager of Apple Records, and so at the end of that recording session, when everything and the band then splits, what happens? Yeah. This is pretty much the end of a pretty good gig, right?
Yeah, except that was, I stayed on till the end of the year, and when we did know the Beatles were breaking up, Ron Cass, who was the president of Apple over there, and Peter Asher, who was the head of A&R, and a guy named Mike Connor, who was the head of publishing. The four of us went to MGM and became the executive, top of the executive staff there, because we just knew Apple, time was running out, and it just wasn't the same anymore. When Klein came in, the whole nature of the Beatles, Apple, the whole thing changed. It went from being a really fun, crazy, I don't know, just a great place to being all of a sudden just not fun anymore. And there was so many problems happening. And we saw the writing on the wall. But I stayed on for the rest of the year.
In the years that followed, did you have any relationship with the members of the band?
Oh, yeah. Of course, Ringo became a Californian. I mean, pretty quick. He spent his time there. He moved there, lived there so long, and there was just a few of us out of the Apple gang. You know, of course, Mal moved over there. So there was a small clique with Harry Nilsson, a bunch of us that hung out all the time together. And then George spent a lot of time there, and George and I became very close on a kind of a deep, just personal level. He was a very gentle man, and our wives became friends, you know, over time. So those are the two relationships that stayed on. I only saw John once after that in L.A. over at Ringo's house, and I saw Paul at a Grammys a few years later. But those, you know, those relationships, communication stayed some, but I never spent any time with the others anymore.
It seems impossible to believe, and I know you probably talk about this all the time, but it seems impossible to believe that there will ever be a group like the Beatles again. Which makes it, to extrapolate that, it seems impossible to think there would ever be a concert like this again.
Well, there'll never be a time like that again, Joe. This was such a special time. You know, this what was happening with society at the time, with Kennedy and Martin Luther King and Vietnam, and what the Beatles represented to the people. There was just something special about that time, that kind of a thing could never happen again, where a band would become so important to the people. They were an escape from all that. They were, the mothers loved them, and the, you know, the fathers loved them. They were a band that just was accepted. And those four people, if Ringo wasn't a drummer, or George wasn't a guitar player or something, any other combination would have not had that appeal like they did. It was just when Ringo was brought into the group at the end, that's when it really, really became the Beatles. And you'll notice after John died, George has asked once, he said, well, will you replace John? He said, well, not as long as he's dead, we won't. You know, they were the Beatles. They were those four people, and that was it.
The name of the book is The Roof, The Beatles' Final Concert. Ken Mansfield, thank you very much for sharing with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Roof, The Beatles' Final Concert, by the man in the white coat, Ken Mansfield, former U.S. manager of Apple Records. The book is published by Post Hill Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
My baby says you're traveling on the one after 909. I said, move over, honey, I'm traveling on that line. I said, move over once.
Come on, baby, don't be cold as ice. Said you're traveling on the one after 909.